Also, you get soft. You're not on the qui vive. You develop flabby muscles because you never get involved in a fight. And so gradually, the successful group fails. The group which managed to obliterate all its enemies will fall apart. So, what are we to do about that? See, part of the whole joke of present-day international politics is that the United States, in order with its vast prosperity and enormous facilities for living the lazy life, must have an external enemy to get excited about. And so even though the Cold War is in a way total nonsense, and everybody who's in the know about anything knows it, that, for example, an atomic war between Russia and the United States would simply end the human race. But the populace has to be kept bamboozled. And we keep fighting wars like in Vietnam in order to keep everybody excited and in order to make a fracas and to give the soldiers practice. It's a horrible business. But that's the way things run. And the question is, you see, can we run the human race without awful bloodshed and murders and tortures and all that kind of thing? Can we somehow introduce a new kind of gamesmanship as a substitute for war? It's the same thing in business. Exactly. If you wipe out your competitor, then you have no reason to produce anything but a lousy product. And then you may make lots of money because you wiped out your competitors, you've got the whole market. And then you've got this money, what are you going to buy with it? Well, there's nothing to buy except other people's lousy products who wiped out their competitors. Or who cheated the public by packaging the thing to look elegant, but it was nothing inside. That's all you've got to buy. So naturally, if you're a success in General Motors, you go and buy a Rolls Royce from England. Or you go and buy a Mercedes from Germany, because they happen to be better cars. Or if you want to make a lot of money in the clothing industry here, making wretched prints, and you want some good clothes, what do? Well, you have to go to Mexico and buy the things peasants wear, because they're still substantial, solid, damn good clothes. So you see, there's something always self-defeating in these attempts to succeed. You could say nothing fails like success. So for this reason, then, the Taoist always had an attitude of caution. Cautious, Lao Tzu says, as one who crosses a river in spring. That means either because of the spring floods or because the ice is still there and you're not quite sure how strong it is, because it's beginning to thaw. So, what the Taoist tries to develop is a sensibility to the situation. He tries to feel out intuitively what kind of action is required under these circumstances, because he feels that he can never discover it analytically with his conscious attention alone. Well, now, to talk in modern Western terms about how this is done, we must realize, of course, that we are equipped inside our heads with an absolutely fantastic thing called the brain. With its millions and millions of neuron cells, it is, as it were, the most amazing computer ever devised. Basic to the Taoist attitude to life is that you have that within you, and you may, if you don't know anything about brains very much, call it intuition or something of that kind. But you have within you the most amazing logical analyzer that exists in the known world. And the point is to get it to work for you. And instead of trying with conscious attention alone, which can only think of about three things at a time without using a pencil, That is to say, keep three variables in mind at once. Very few people can do four without using a pencil. You can do four if you're a trained musician, where you've got you're playing four different lines of a fugue, say. You're keeping four variables in mind at once. With an organist, you can go from four to six because you've got your 2 feet, and they're playing two. But that requires a high amount of training to be able, with conscious attention, to keep these many variables in mind. But the world around us has infinitely many variables going in it. And you can reason out something with your conscious verbal thinking. Say you want to make a contract in business, and you figure out how to make it, whether it will be a good contract, whether it will work, etc., etc. And you think of all these things and write them down, and you make the contract, and you think that's fine. But one of the variables that you couldn't possibly include in the contract was that your partner would slip on a banana skin and break his neck. All sorts of things. I mean, the contract might make provisions in it if your lawyer was thoughtful for what was to be done under the case of the disability of any of the parties thereto, etc. But eventually, there are so many possibilities that can occur that you cannot think of them all. So then the question arises, is it within the power of the human brain to comprehend, because of its immense complexity, in a kind of un- or subconscious way, what the surface consciousness can never grasp? And the Taoist would say, certainly it can. That you've got to learn to use your brain by allowing it to go to work on your problems without interfering with it. And then it will deliver you a decision. And this is why when you get to the real study of Taoist and Zen Buddhist practice, you get to the point where you learn to act without making decisions. Or rather, to use a more exact word, without choosing. Krishnamurti talks a great deal about being choicelessly aware. And he says freedom is precisely the state of not having to choose. Now that sounds quite paradoxical, because we're always talking about freedom of choice. But choice is not a form of freedom in the sense of the word. What is choice in the sense of the word? Choice is the act of hesitation that we make before making a decision. It is a mental wobbling. You know, some people, when they take up a pen to write, they don't just write, but they jiggle the pen around indecisively like this and then start writing. Or a person comes into a room and wonders who to talk to and sort of is in doubt, you see. In that moment, he's choosing. Whereas a person who comes into a room and decides who to approach, he doesn't wait to choose. We say he is decisive. But that's a funny saying, because it means he doesn't stop to decide. So in the training in Zen Buddhism, which is simply a Buddhist extension of Taoism, Zen Buddhism arose out of the marriage of Buddhism and Taoism in the 5th century AD. And over the following centuries. So they have a way of training you so that you always act without choosing. For example, there was one day a leaky roof, and there were a couple of monks attending the Zen master, and he said, the roof is leaking. One monk disappeared and came back instantly with a sieve and put it under the drips. Another monk, after some time, came back with a bucket. The master praised the one who brought the sieve. Now, the action wasn't exactly appropriate, to catching rain. But the point was that he was in the spirit of the Zen discipline by acting without choosing. And you will notice this with certain people. Certain people never hesitate. They always seem, if something needs to be done, they seem somehow simply to grab something and do it. You know, which is a kind of a Zen capacity. But so what happens is this, that the teacher of Zen constantly throws curves at his students and puts them in dilemma situations where they have to act immediately.